Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Corey Robin will be on to explain what makes right-wingers tick. Tomorrow is the day that Mississippi votes on a personhood amendment, and The View looks at an incident where the TSA searched a woman's bag because of her vibrator and decide to make it all about whether or not it's right for women to travel with vibrators. I still can't wrap my mind around how incredibly silly this story makes Americans sound.
Yale University researchers have looked into whether there are any increases or decreases in use of C-sections on holidays. They found a 12% increase in cesarean births on Valentine's Day and a nearly 17% drop on Halloween. The conclusion is that some women are manipulating the date for their child's birth to coincide with a holiday, or avoid one. Tisha Johnson with the Iowa chapter of the International Cesarean Awareness Network says that's no reason to have a C-section.
This story makes two things very clear. One, that fundy paranoia about Halloween is way out of control. Two, the claims that the high C-section rate in this country is being driven strictly by doctors are overstated. It's clear that many women straight up prefer to give birth that way, and the discussion should take that into account. It's tough to turn down covering the Herman Cain sexual harassment story, but there's something more pressing this week that demands this slot. Tomorrow, November 8th, Mississippi voters will be voting on a constitutional amendment declaring fertilized eggs to be legal persons. If that ballot initiative becomes law, the ramifications for all women of reproductive age in Mississippi and their families will be severe. How severe is up for debate, but we do know that similar laws in Mexico have resulted in women being investigated and even imprisoned for miscarriages. Mexico hasn't seen any results in terms of restricting the birth control pill, at least that I've seen, but that may not hold in the U.S. Anti-choicers here are willing to use pseudoscience claiming that the pill kills fertilized eggs in order to restrict it. There's no evidence that it does kill fertilized eggs, but that something isn't true has never stopped it from being written into law. It will definitely call into question the whole process of in vitro fertilization, and probably ban it, since you pretty much have to kill fertilized eggs to make it work. But Mississippi being what it is, I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing tampons held as evidence in criminal investigations against women who have what the law deems suspicious menstrual cycles. The man who organized the campaign to get the personhood amendment on the ballot in Mississippi is quite the character, as Right Wing Watch has discovered. This ad campaign from the opponents of Initiative 26 runs down what a fanatic he is.
The architect of the amendment is a man named Les Riley. Before Initiative 26, Les Riley was best known for being a modern-day secessionist. He spent years encouraging people to leave their hometowns, their families, and their jobs to move to a rural location in South Carolina to start a new country. He proclaimed that the United States was godless. Before that, he was leader of a group called League of the South, which openly admits that they seek to break apart the United States.
One of the biggest features of the campaign to pass this amendment has been its aggressive attack on rape victims. Supporters of the amendment have been touring the state explaining why it's just awesome to force women to bear the children of rapists. Their evidence? They have a couple of people who claim to have been conceived in rape and are just begging us to say to their face that they shouldn't have been born. Of course, by that logic, they also require the rape to exist. So really, they should be asked if they support legalizing rape alongside outlawing abortion in order to make sure that no potential child is deprived of a chance of being born just because some sperm out there is rapist sperm. In response, the opponents of the bill have a woman who survived being raped and shot three times touring the state, explaining why women like her need to have the protection of the law. Seriously, I can't believe we're having to debate how much abuse we get to dish out to rape survivors. Anyway, this woman, named Kristen Hemmons, was on Rachel Maddow to explain her strategy.
Well, a lot of Mississippians are very conservative, as most people know. The vast majority of them say they're pro-life. So, you know, I have to talk to Mississippians every day who are like Mitt Romney. And the way I talk about it is that it's big government going way too far. It's government making personal health care decisions. It's government getting in between doctors and their patients in the emergency room. And since there are no exceptions for rape or incest or the health of the mother, you know, so many doctors' groups have come out in against this initiative. And, you know, mainly we just talk about how it's government going too far, and that scares people.
Hemmons goes on to say the birth control argument is working maybe not as well because people don't really understand the issue. I also imagine that in a place as conservative as Mississippi, getting people to rally behind contraception isn't as easy as it might be somewhere else. There's a lot of pressure in the Bible Belt to front like you're anti-sex for pleasure, even if you're not. Hard to explain it, but having seen it up close, I can say it's about pursing your lips and talking up ideals while then turning around and doing what you please. Drinking in dry counties is like that too. Everyone does it and then pats themselves on the back for having laws against it. It's very strange. But explaining how you could be jailed for a miscarriage or have a medical emergency while pregnant that results in doctors fearing treating you for fear of breaking the law? That can happen to even good Christian housewives who only do it in the missionary position once a month, and instead of enjoying sex for itself, pray that it results in a conception. Even they will be hurt by this. So while I wish that pro-choicers in Mississippi could be more aggressive about arguing how all women have a right to live their lives, I can see why they're using this tactic. So let's have Maddow summarize the potential consequences of this amendment one more time.
If a fertilized egg is a person legally, anything that stops a fertilized egg from eventually becoming a live birth becomes a crime, potentially becomes murder. So if you have a miscarriage, that could be grounds for criminal investigation into manslaughter or murder. It could make fertility treatment illegal. Same goes for many common forms of birth control, any form of hormonal birth control, like the hormonal birth control used sometimes in the IUD or the birth control pill. Certainly the morning after pill, they could potentially be made illegal by this thing. Not to mention, of course, banning all abortion, no exceptions, full stop.
I've harped enough on this show about how the pill, especially the morning after pill, has never actually been shown to kill fertilized eggs. In fact, research into the morning after pill showed that it simply does not. But Rachel is 100% right that this bill could be used to ban the pill and the IUD. They don't need good science to make their case. After all, the people backing this amendment openly want a theocracy. They don't give a whiff for science. Let's hope the people of Mississippi see these dangerous, theocratic misogynists for what they are before it's too late. I'd like to welcome Corey Robin to the program. Corey teaches political science at Brooklyn College in the CUNY Graduate Center. He's written a new book called The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin, and he's here to help pick the reactionary mind for us. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Corey.
Thanks for having me.
There's a whole bunch of theories trying to get to the essence of what it means to be a conservative, which I find a somewhat misleading term. You go with the term reactionary yourself. What's generally the theory of what makes somebody, what's your general theory of what makes somebody reactionary or the thinking behind reactionary politics?
A reactionary is somebody who is sort of initially aroused by a democratic movement of emancipation from below, aroused by, brought to political consciousness by that movement. And then in response opposes that movement. There's something about that movement that gets awakened for the reactionary that he sees as problematic. But in the course of reacting against that movement, what's interesting is that the reactionary will oftentimes borrow from that movement and use different tactics and tropes and ideas from that movement in order to oppose it. And this is why I don't think the word conservative is the right term, because oftentimes you find that that conservatives are not at all interested in conserving anything. What they are interested in is preserving certain established relationships of privilege and hierarchy, and in attempting to preserve those, they'll oftentimes engage in the most radical forms of transformation.
And just for clarification, can liberals be reactionaries?
Liberals can be reactionaries. There's been a lot of liberal opposition to reform and revolutionary movements from below. But my book really focuses most on the right, which has been the kind of the most formidable form of reaction in modern politics and history.
And what movements do you think the modern conservative, for lack of a better term, movement is reacting to specifically?
Well, I think it begins with a reaction to what was once called the labor question. This is when in the late 1880s and 1890s, workers really begin asserting their rights in the workplace and outside the workplace. And that's really where modern conservatism takes its form. What happens after the Second World War is it begins to react to a host of other movements as well. In the 1950s and 1960s, the civil rights movement. And then, of course, I think that the real final movement that pushes the modern conservative movement into its into victory, really, is its reaction against the women's movement. That's the ultimate form of emancipation and liberation that really pushes the conservative movement over the top.
And this show concentrates on feminist issues and reproductive rights issues. So I'd like to kind of pick your brain on a couple of issues related to that. I noticed that there's what you might call an obsession with masculinity on the right. How does this really factor into your theory?
I don't use the term masculinity, but it's actually quite central to the book's argument. One of the things that you notice when you look at reactionary movements going back to the French Revolution, which is really the birthplace of all these movements, is that the reactionary and the conservative, and again, I use these terms interchangeably in the book, see that one of the reasons why a revolution or a reform movement has managed to take hold, according to the conservative, is that the ruling classes have become weak. They have become degenerate, decadent, and oftentimes the language is the language of effeminacy. They've really lost their kind of physical vitality and been made feminine. And you actually see this in an interesting way in Burke's original, one of his early works called A Philosophical Inquiry on the Sublime and the Beautiful, where he really opposes feminine beauty to a kind of masculine vitality. And so this really runs throughout conservative thought and politics from the very beginning. And oftentimes what these conservatives will say is that if we're going to have a real ruling class, if we're going to rejuvenate ourselves, we have to become more masculine. We have to become more physically powerful, more intellectually supple and strong. And warfare is oftentimes thought to be the kind of the preeminent sphere of masculine rejuvenation. So there's a real fundamental attraction to warfare on the part of the right. And it's not a psychological attraction. It's really an ideological attraction because they see warfare as the means by which, real men can be made.
Now, of course, I would point out that your average right-winger nowadays would deny adamantly that they support the idea of creating an elite ruling class.
Right.
So what's your response to that?
Well, it's a twofold response. One of the arguments of the book is that a real challenge for the right from the very beginning has always been to make these defenses of a ruling class in a context that is democratic. So how do you defend privilege in the face of the French Revolution, for instance, which is an assault upon privilege and is a very popular assault on privilege? How do you defend the rights of slaveholders in a context where there are not many slaveholders? How do you defend the rights of capital in the face of a movement that really represents a majority and is denying those rights of capital? This has been a challenge all along, and one of the ways that I argue that conservatism has managed to meet that challenge is to what I call it has made privilege popular. It has tried to turn people who are not from the elite into a kind of mass aristocracy, and it has done this in a wide variety of ways. So, for instance, under slavery, the master class, which was a very exclusive elite, really tried to make, in a certain way, tried to make it possible for all white men in the South to become slaveholders, to become little lords themselves. I also think that the family is a critical way in which the right has done this. It has turned fathers and husbands, who might themselves be quite poor and quite marginal in society, it has elevated them to the status of a little lord, that you are the sort of the lord and the king of your family, and that's the sphere in which you are like us, the elite. So I don't think it's surprising that the modern right claims that it doesn't stand for a ruling class, because that's really been the way the right as a whole has always defended privilege, is by making the ruling class more popular and populist than it actually is. And so that's why you see, for instance, in the Tea Party, there's an extraordinarily high degree of opposition to undocumented immigrants and immigration in general, much higher than there is in the general population. And that's because it's defending the kind of the privileges of, you know, for lack of a better, white Americans against a kind of subordinate class coming in from afar.
And how would you characterize reproductive rights and the struggle over that fitting into this paradigm?
I think it's really central, and I think oftentimes on the left, particularly people who are more interested in sort of economic questions on the left, they really mischaracterize, and I think in a way dismiss the centrality of the struggle over reproductive rights. As I argue in the book, what does conservatism and reactionary politics oppose in reform or revolutionary or left-wing movements? What they oppose is the emancipation of individual men and women from their superiors, particularly from their superiors in what we oftentimes call the private sphere. In the 20th century, I think that's been the workplace on the one hand and the family on the other hand. The movement for reproductive rights, going back from its very beginning, was a multifaceted movement, but one of the things that it entailed was the assertion of a woman's agency over what she was going to do with her own body. This is a very personal, very intimate kind of assertion, and for that reason is very explosive and very threatening and very dangerous to certain forms of hierarchy. And so I think the battle over reproductive rights is really, you know, quite critical, not just for feminists, but to the opposition to feminism. And so one of the most interesting things is after the 2010 midterm election, if you look at what all these Republicans who came in on the wave of this sort of Tea Party mobilization, what were the two front lines of their activity after they assumed power in all those state legislatures and those gubernatorial offices?
Abortion.
One was abortion and reproductive, and now reproductive rights more generally, as we're seeing in Mississippi. The other is workplace rights, with all these battles over public sector unions. Those are the front lines of their defense, because they really involve, like I say, this very personal, intimate form of agency on the part of a subordinate class, whether it be a worker or a woman in a marriage.
So I think we have time for one last question, but I'm interested in your take on this. You know, historically speaking, sexual alarmism about their political opponents has been a mainstay of right-wing discourse, and you're really seeing that come back with the reaction to Occupy Wall Street. I've been chronicling on this show all sorts of things, you know, the claims that there's orgies in the streets, that they're all sexual deviants, that sort of thing. Why do they go to sex so quickly when the disagreement isn't about that at all?
Well, I think it actually picks up on what I was just saying, that remember, for the conservative, what do revolutionary or reformist or left movements represent? They really represent this assertion of agency in a sphere that for the conservative is really a very private sphere, the workplace or the family. And, you know, sexuality is the ultimate form of a kind of personal relationship. And I think the reason why they go to that is that it really stands for a kind of an assertion of independence from the kind of control over of a superior. And I think that's what, you know, when they see that, and they're not new in this. I mean, you go back to Burke's writing on the French Revolution, you see the same kind of language of sexual alarmism. He saw it interestingly enough, in the kind of the dress and the costume that the French revolutionaries were using, the kind of the openness of that, and the and their willingness to go into the bedroom of Marie Antoinette and abduct her and march her. And he spends about, sorry, this is a historical tangent, but he spends, the longest passage in his text is just about, it's the language of rape and the language of kind of removing the costume of civilization. And so I think for the conservative, there's just sexuality, it really does stand in for these kinds of all forms of transgression, which are very personal and very intimate assaults on the power of a superior class.
My guest today has been Corey Robin, and the book is titled The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. You can buy it online or at your local bookstore. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Corey.
Thanks very much. Enjoyed it. I got love for you if you were born
in the 80s, the 80s. As you know from listening to this podcast, my general theory about the incursions on reproductive rights goes something like this. Hostility to reproductive rights is based in fear and loathing of sexuality, especially female sexuality. Anti-choicers are at the extreme end of this, but they don't face enough opposition in the general public because while the public at large isn't as misogynist as anti-choicers, they still think of female sexuality as icky and aren't going to go to great lengths to defend it. And if you doubt that this is true, I highly recommend watching the ladies of The View respond to an incident that actually happened to my friend and colleague, Jill Filipovich of Feministe. You see, Jill was traveling and checked a bag that happened to have a vibrator in it, and her bag got searched, which isn't surprising. The TSA loves to flag bags with sex toys in it, which is your first clue that we as a society haven't accepted the idea that women getting off is a fine thing that shouldn't trouble anyone. And if they search your bag, they have to leave a note saying so. The agent in this case scribbled the note, "Get your freak on, girl," which was simultaneously funny and disturbing since it was a direct acknowledgement that they think a woman who wants some orgasms while traveling is suspicious enough that you need to search her bag. Anyway, Jill tweeted and blogged about it, the TSA agent got fired, which wasn't the point at all, and The View covered it. And their reaction shows why we as a country have a long way to go when it comes to growing up and accepting that women like sex and there's nothing wrong with that.
And she said she initially laughed it off, but then became disturbed by the invasion of privacy, so she tweeted it, and emailed the story to the New York Magazine, but she was really embarrassed.
Yeah, right.
First of all, Jill said she was amused and disturbed at the same time, which isn't that unusual. That's how I feel watching this segment of The View, for instance. Second of all, she never said she was embarrassed. That's pure conjecture from Whoopi Goldberg, and it feeds right into the idea that women should be embarrassed that they have sexual urges. If this happened to a man who was traveling with a Playboy in his bag, no one would assume that he was fronting like he was ashamed. It would be understood that he was amused but upset that the TSA is going through his things. But because it's a woman, we just assume that there's some shame going on, even if there's not. But honestly, Whoopi was the least offensive person in this entire situation. She actually defends the use of vibrators and makes some funny jokes, such as saying she carries hers in a holster. Sherry Shepherd is the one who takes this whole situation to a new level of offensiveness.
First of all, I just wonder, why does everybody feel like they got to take the daggone vibrator every freaking where they go?
Oh yeah, because if a woman likes sex, she must be up for it at all times and all places. Look, this isn't about taking a vibrator everywhere you go. This isn't about bringing a vibrator to the grocery store or the movie theater. It's perfectly reasonable to bring a vibrator when you travel. In fact, I'd say that thinking about sexual activity that is possible on the road should be up there with considering how you're going to wash your hair. If you're single, you should definitely travel with condoms as well. Like the Boy Scout said, be prepared. And what's nice about sexual items is they take up like no room whatsoever in your bag, so there's no reason not to bring them. Except the TSA will search your stuff, which is why I'm a fan of the carry-on. At least when they search your bag that way, you see what they're doing. But the notion that anyone who carries a vibrator while traveling is somehow an out-of-control sex maniac was still not the craziest thing said during this segment. No, the ladies of The View did us a favor and spelled out exactly why there's something so damn threatening about women who take control over their own pleasure like this.
That's why I don't use a vibrator, because I got this man with equipment that just is absolutely wonderful.
I don't have to do nothing. I don't let vibrators keep the man home.
So there you have it. Women shouldn't masturbate because their husbands are the sole owners of their sexual pleasure. In fact, masturbating somehow implies that your husband isn't doing his job. This is messed up in all sorts of ways. I appreciate that Whoopi Goldberg was, with humor, trying to disagree with Shepard on this. But I think she fell a little short, because she still ended up conceding the notion that if your man is in your vicinity, he's got sole rights to control your sexual pleasure, and you shouldn't be getting your own hands dirty, as it were. I want to add one thing. It's notable that The View basically responded to this story mainly by investigating whether or not it's acceptable to masturbate, or whether or not that makes you a dirty whore. You know, instead of asking hard questions about why the TSA is flagging bags for having vibrators in them. They take it as a given that a woman who travels with a vibrator is a suspect character. And they take it as a given that women masturbating is up for debate in a way that men masturbating simply isn't. If masturbating while you travel is so damn scandalous, where is The View segment where they flip out because there's porn available for purchase in like every hotel room ever? Or does that not bear mention? Because that's there with a male audience in mind, and no one thinks less of a man who takes his sexual business into his own hands. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Oh Give Me a Break edition. This is one of those moments on Fox News that's just there to piss off the liberals.
Lesson, Bob, is this teaching the children that just because you're bad at something, you have to skip it. If we skipped everything we were bad at, I would never do laundry. There'd be no women's sports.
It feels pointless to reply to this by noting our women's soccer team's performance or the existence of Serena Williams. I'll just go on to say that it's a sad and sorry existence you must have if pissing off liberals is how you get your jollies. I mean, I don't sit around hoping that what I say is really going to get under conservative skin. If I'm bored, I read a book or play some records. There's just something deeply pitiful about how pissing off liberals is such a priority for so many right-wingers.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.